When asked what a cinematographer does, he speaks in tongues. His home movies have been submitted to the Library of Congress for their cultural significance. It's called an Oscar because he declined to use his name. He is the most interesting DP in the world.
I don't always listen to podcasts, but when I do, I prefer Make Me Watch. Stay tuned, my friends.
Yes, yes, y'all, and you don't stop. To the beat, y'all, and you don't stop. Yes, yes, y'all, and you don't stop. A 1-2, y'all, and you don't stop. Yes, yes, y'all, and you don't stop. Until the beat comes, there's a beat, a short shot, come on. Come
I met
on,
this girl when I was 10 years old. And what I love most, she had so much soul. She was old school and I was just a shorty, never knew. Throughout my life, she would be there for me on the regular.
So what you just heard up top is a little from Commons, I Used to Love Her, one of hip-hop's universal classic songs, which Common Sense likens the journey of hip-hop itself to the cultural changes a woman traveling from NY to LA experiences and the highs and lows of that journey. So creating, to me, one of the most beautiful analogous storytelling feats any rapper has ever done. It's still referenced to this day. We just had with Dot, with GNX and Gloria. It very much takes that same format. Scary ass J. Cole and The Fall Off just kind of redid that little format, traveling up to NY, going to Atlanta. Y'all's boy out in Chicago, the Black Nazi in Homecoming for his album Graduation, kind of had a very similar format of taking Common Sense as I Used to Love Her and giving it a different spin. So the structure of this song, I feel like, is important. Not only is it a Chicago native, but because there's a shocking reveal at the end. And I think not only does the genre, hip hop genre as a whole, use these sort of shocking sort of reveals at the end. I feel like our filmmaker that we're talking to today has a strong sense of structure and a shocking reveal for his film Tubi that we're going to get started talking about a little later on in the episode. But up top, Will, I want to give you an opportunity to maybe share a song with us that you were listening to that like maybe helped you with the writing process or something that influenced the film. What song was playing in your ears while you were creating Tubi?
There were no songs. I mean, I couldn't listen to anything because my process was basically just all the information that was coming in and what I was seeing, it rained out the movie. And I say rain out because it's like Rain Man. I start talking to somebody and I just spit it out and just start vomiting. And then the project disappears. But the opening, I'm not sure if anybody paid attention to.
The bridge is over.
Not The Bridge Is Over, but Pulp Fiction.
Oh, yeah.
Pulp Fiction
yeah.
opens.
Yeah, oh, well, you're talking to two filmmakers walking out of a whole Bloody Affair screening a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
Right. Latino hands on this one. Yeah, yeah.
But sure. So Pulp Fiction, the way Pulp Fiction opened is the same way Tubi opens.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to use the same song he used, but I thought The Bridge Is Over was fitting for that because The Bridge Is Over, meaning that the bridge between bad movies and people just talking about them online and not making a movie, that bridge is over because I'm making a movie about what everybody's watching online.
I love that.
And with me making destroying that bridge and saying, this is the movie y'all don't know you want to see. This is the movie that you want to see that you keep posting about. This is the movie you keep reacting about. The bridge is over now. This is it.
Here's a little bridges over for the audience, and we'll get started here with Shooting Shit coming up after this.
I said, the bridge is over, the bridge is over. The bridge is over, the bridge is over. Hey, the bridge is over, the bridge is over. The bridge is over, the bridge is over. You see me coming in the dance with the flippers and see ya down with the sound called BDP.
All right, welcome to Shooting Shit. This is Ian McGee shooting the shit about the ish they're effing with. And on today's episode, we have a writer, director, cinematographer, casting director, location scout, locations manager, gaffer and key grip, sound and art department, armorer, stunt coordinator and craft services, and founder of Low Key Productions, an independent film company focused on original storytelling and theatrical exhibition. He's a one-man show. He does it all. Will Adams, thank you for joining us today. How are you, man?
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you guys having me on today.
We're here to talk about the Tubi movie. I'm going to throw it to my co-host, McGee. Tell us a little bit about this, man.
You saw it?
Oh, yeah. We both watched it.
You ain't see dude?
What?
You didn't see, man. What it was right here. It was a dude with a microphone. Well,
come on, man. Ain't nobody there. Come on. Where we supposed to be going again?
You're supposed to be taking me downtown, but we could change the plot.
Thank you for giving me your undivided attention.
May I help you?
It's Jonah here.
And you are?
I'm Erica, his wife. And who might you be?
I'm Pam.
Who the heck are you?
Just met. Remember? I'm Tammy.
Do you know what happened to him?
According to his chart, he had blunt force trauma to the head when he arrived. He was unconscious with his girlfriend.
With his who?
What you doing?
I'm parking.
You realize we've been here this entire time, right?
Now, fool, we've been driving.
Who wrote this?
All right, that was from the trailer for Tubi movie. This is a 2026 release. This is a logline, a wild Chicago indie satire where a low-budget film crew loses control when the characters realize they're trapped in their own movie. Breaking the fourth wall and roasting today's viral streaming culture, this is written, directed by our guest, Will Adams, shot by Will Adams. This is starring Damon Williams as Jason, Adele Givens as Angie. We got Brandon Cole as Reese and Phylana Sanders as Erica. And among others, this is a huge ensemble piece here. Mm-hmm. But like my co-host said already, thank you for joining us here. I'm really excited to talk about this movie. Like we said before, both filmmakers ourselves. I grew up in like Midwest Illinois area. I'm not going to claim Chicago. I'm not going to be one of those people that says I'm from Chicago and you ask where, and it's like 90 minutes away. No, I'm not one of those. But I had my career out in LA though, shooting hot nonsense for a good decade. But this reminded me most of my like Channel 101 days. I don't know if you ever heard of Channel 101. No. It was this like 2000s, 2010s kind of independent film festival out in L.A. It was once a month. It was started by Dan Harmon and Rob Schrab. But it was once a month, 5-minute TV shows. It was 10 5-minute shows went up against each other. The audience voted for their favorite five, and then their favorite five went on. But that was the kind of like indie filmmaking spirit that got me to buy my first camera, which is what ended up making me make the journey to LA. And this movie just reminded me so much of that spirit. I was like texting my old Channel 101 buddies and like shooting the shit about the old time. So I'm really excited to get in and talk about this movie with you.
Did you tell them to watch the movie?
Oh, hell yeah. Hell yeah.
Okay. All right. Okay. I wanted to make sure you ended it with that part. Okay.
Will, I want to start here. Before we get into your present work, I want to get a sense of the man we're interviewing. You base your second short, I believe, My Enemy's Son, on a Scarface lyric. Is that correct?
Yes. Not a lyric, a song.
Song, excuse me. And you end this film, like we mentioned, with The Bridge Is Over a little earlier. So it feels like you have, or hip-hop has a strong sense in your work. I want to ask you up top your Mount Rushmore hip-hop pick, or rapper picks.
It would be Eric B. This has changed a couple of times. Eric B. Rakim.
I was going to say, Rakim.
Rakim, KRS-One, for sure. Slick Rick, for sure, storyteller. Mm. And then Biggie and Jay-Z.
Okay, so we share two of those. I'm because Big is a constant for me too in terms of storytelling. Like I'm a storyteller, you know, to my heart. So I love storytelling about lyrics. So that's interesting because I feel like in terms of storytelling, what you've been building over at Low Key is really distinct. And it's a body of work, I feel, that's observant without being distant. I feel like it's critical without losing empathy. Going back to Sex Ain't Love, I think there's already a through line there of you interrogating performance and how people maybe present themselves versus what's actually going on underneath the surface. And in doing so, I don't feel like you let the audience off the hook either. And you're very confrontational. And your work feels like it's very confrontational for an audience. With 2B Movie, it feels like the lens widens a bit. Like individuals are not just performing for each other, but creators themselves, you as the creator, are performing for an ecosystem. And we're having to perform for these already set trend ecosystems, the algorithms almost, maybe algorithms we don't really see or know. But I'm curious, as you, as I mentioned, seeing some of your other interviews, I'm getting the sense that other filmmakers who are within these ecosystems who sort of pride themselves with these 2B movies have taken a bit of offense to what you've done here. In fact, you mentioned maybe a time or two in which somebody wanted to throw their hands with you at a festival based on what they're seeing here. So I'm wondering, like, with the work, is the aim of the work to inspire those to do better, like a rising tide lifts all ships, or do you feel comfortable with the, I just want to point, hold up a lens, hold up a mirror, even if it edges a little bit into mockery? Like, where do you feel like the tone, the spirit of the movie for that particular audience would be?
The disclaimer is to make you be better. That's what the disclaimer is for. The rest of the movie is basically what everybody online posting. It's showing them, it's giving them the movie that they don't know, they didn't know they wanted to see. If you think about it, it created its own genre. Tubi movie. That's what these movies are called. They take these things from, you don't know the names of the movies. You just know that they're called Tubi movies because that's what people say. Come on, Tubi, do better. I watched a Tubi movie the other day, You never hear them say they watch Eric's movie or they watch Sean's movie. You hear them say Tubi movie. So Tubi movie is basically giving everybody the movie that they didn't know they wanted to see and giving them the ability to see that the actors break character and point out the same thing they point out so they can laugh with us instead of at us. I know you, that's a constant thing I say, but that's the focus, to get them to laugh with us instead of at us, because when they posting these movies online, they're laughing at the filmmaker. The filmmaker, if it's not even great and they put a lot of work into their project, they don't expect it to be laughed at, you know, and made fun of. They don't have a chance to make fun of this movie because we're making fun of ourselves, so we can laugh with us at us. And that's the focus of the movie. It's not to shit on anybody that made a bad movie. They make a bad movie, that's on you. That's why I said at the very beginning, disclaimer says, this movie is not like anything anybody's ever done. And if it is like something somebody's done, it's purely coincidental. And if it is like something you've done, be a better filmmaker. Hmm. Point blank. Because I made sure that all the bad stuff that I've seen, I didn't replicate it. I just created something similar. Like the Three Sammies.
I kind of want to leap off that point because I feel like I believe people may be under the impression that creating a purposely bad movie is easy. And yeah, we want to go ahead and dispel that rumor right away.
Because it's not. Yeah. Because here's the thing. If you feel like you're a good filmmaker, the process is beginning, middle, and end. And I had to have a beginning, middle, and end. If I didn't, this would have just been a movie full of sketches. Hmm. So somebody said, hey, this reminds me of Hollywood Shuffle. No, Hollywood Shuffle is a movie with sketches. It's a movie filled with sketches. It's basically Saturday Night Live as a movie with sketches in it. This is a movie that's self-aware, where the actors break character and complain about the same thing that you would complain about. So my struggle was making sure that it had a beginning, middle, and end, and it had to make sure that these jokes hit right so people will understand it and feel it and not feel like that, okay, well, that was a cheap shot. He just made that and he got that one off. I give that to him. No, these jokes are intentional, like, and they hit you where you least expect it. Just like in the trailer when the guy walks past the camera Damon walks past the camera. I mean the microphone, and like, hey, it's a guy with a microphone. You watching and you see them walking and you're like, this is a guy with a mic. Before you can say it, he's saying it, and y'all are like, oh shit, he's saying the same thing I said. They're on FaceTime with you talking about the same thing that's going on in the movie. So you're feeling the same emotion at the same time.
One of the things I love on that, like, I think the density of the jokes really goes a long way towards selling it, so that it doesn't feel like it's mean-spirited or targeted at any one particular thing. Like, even the final shot of the movie with the girl who's in bed with you, is the book is upside down that she's pretending to read, is just like, there's just like constantly just tiny little details in there, just like continuity notes and stuff. Like, there's all the things that you, like you said, that the characters call attention to, but then there's so many other details that nobody calls attention to. They're just there.
Yeah.
People, if you know, you know.
And some people mention it, and then I'll ask them, did you see the camera on the window? What window? Watch it again. Tell them to call. Watch it again and call.
That's good filmmaking, is to encourage those rewatches and the details, and to ride that line of like trying to do a like parody, but also like leaving the richness in there for the rewatches is very fun.
Okay, Eric, what you got?
I want to talk to you about your process. So I love kind of diving into like the literal nuts and bolts of a writer. Daily Rituals is a book that I keep near me, which has a whole showcase of famous people and what their days actually look like. So talk to me about what you need as a writer to get your prolific kind of scripts done. So are you, I need this pen, I write these many pages a day, I write in the mornings, I write in the evenings. What is it about your process that you can share? Because I think one of the valuable things I've learned over the course of this week is your write the script, secure the locations, hire the talent is a, you know, a sure, steadfast way for you to get things done and get things started. Very curious what your day-to-day creative process looks like.
Well, you want to know when I write, or you want to know how I come up with the idea? Because I come up with the idea and I come up with the entire script in my head before I actually write it.
Interesting.
Like, it's weird because if I come up with an idea, I get on the phone with you and we start talking, and then now your job is just to sit there and listen to me rattle off all the stuff that I come up with. And you don't say anything. A lot of times my friends like, is that it? Yep. All right. Talk to you later. Hang up. But I just start vomiting everything out and just talking and saying all the stuff that's going to be in the script. And then Aaron Hills, the guy that was the young dad at the beginning, when he read the script, he was like, bro, this is crazy. You just told me about all of this before you wrote it. I said, it's up here, but once it comes from up here, it's gone. Once I drop it into the computer, it's gone. It doesn't exist anymore. Unless it's not right. If it's not right, I'll remember it, and then I'll go back and then fix something or add something or take something out. But once I drop it in, it's gone. So for me to write, if I sit down and start writing, I write as much as I can until I have to do something, and then I'll pull away and I'll try to save my eyes, because I hate looking at the screen that long. And then I start writing again. I have my phone. Yeah. I got final draft on my phone. I got final draft on my computer. I got final draft on my iPad. So wherever I go, I'm writing. I wrote a Marvel project that I really can't talk about that I'm pitching. Well, I got a lawyer pitching for me. And it took me 2 weeks. It took me 13 days to write that. Mm. And the reason why it took 13 days is because I kept having to, yo, can you help me pick up this thing and move this into my house? Yeah, all right. So it's back and forth doing stuff like that. But when I get an idea, like that one, I was possessed. I just kept writing and writing and writing and writing. As I'm coming up with stuff, writing more, it just comes out. And then once it's done, I'm like, whew. It's like, I don't even know. It's like having gas and you don't want to fart around nobody. You got to push it out. And once you fart.
It's flow state. You're hitting flow state. Like I think that's two different styles of writers for sure. The ones that like can go back and re-edit and stuff. But like when you're in that flow state and it feels like it's just like, no, this is exactly what I want. Like
Tubi took me 3 days to write. I got ideas from my friends. They told me, hey, try this. And I looked and said, okay, well, I'm gonna try that because this is too close to this other thing that I just saw. Cause like I said, I don't want filmmakers to think that I'm shitting on them, because you want to fight. Is it, show me one thing in there that resembles your movie. Well, nothing. You talk about bad filmmakers. No, I'm talking about people online roasting bad filmmakers and giving them the movie that they want to see, opposed to the ones they're cutting up and posting for 30 seconds and then getting all these likes and comments. This is the movie that I created for them.
Let me ask you in terms of, with that writing process, are you going back, are there redrafts, or are you doing that kind of editing in your head? Like as you're coming up with the scenes, the sketches?
In my head. And it's bad because just say, for instance, I'm reading, rereading it, and then I'm writing it, and I'm writing it, and I'm writing it, and I'm writing it. And then you can go back and you read. So I'm somewhere where I'm not near a computer. I'm driving. I have this idea that I want to put in, but I'm on the expressway doing 70. You know, and, you know, I have to hold this idea in my head until I get somewhere where I can pull over safely,
right,
and put this down. And hopefully that nobody calls or nothing happens that throws me off. So I'll forget and then I have to remember later on, because I'll sit up all night trying to remember that idea until I get it back and then push it in.
Got to get you a little tape recorder, like the old school. Like,
yeah, people say that, but I just feel like I'm talking to myself and I feel crazy.
So get you a little rubber duck to talk to and the tape recorder.
People always say phone has record memo on it. I can easily put it in there, but I think I don't like the way I sound. I think that's it. I think I hate the way I sound.
Curious with that, as we're talking about the writing process, you elect not to, based on another interview I've heard, to use the N-word in your films in terms of your writing. You don't want your characters to, please, correct me if I'm wrong.
Not this movie, in this movie.
Oh, in this movie particular?
Yes.
Why was that important for this movie? I'm curious. As opposed to about the other work that you would have.
Because when Sean is telling his friends about it and he's reciting lines from it, he won't have to worry about if he's saying it or not.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easier for you to recite these lines, telling people about what happened, and without using it. And then if you don't use it, if I don't use it in the movie, you don't have to worry about thinking like, because it's curse words in the movie, but mm-hmm. N words not in the movie. And that's purposeful,
yeah.
Because I, when all facets of life see the movie, I don't want them to be worried about saying it.
Do you feel like the features before, like your next one's coming up, that's less of a concern? You're less of, like, I guess an audience you're targeting depends. This audience, you want a wider audience for the TV movie. For other ones, it's a little bit more tailored for a certain audience. So it's
Plight. I don't think I use it in Plight either, but that's not purpose. That's not on purpose. It's just because we just don't use it. And I think so. My Enemy Son was the first hood movie I've done. Kidnap was my really first movie, which was about an FBI agent going after the kingpin of Chicago, whatever. But I had a friend, I think you probably heard this, I had a friend tell me that you know more than just that. Mm-hmm. You know, so you need to get away from that. And I got away from it because I felt like, you know, he's right. I know more than just the streets. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the only thing I see. And right now, everybody is trying to get the next movie that looks like Power or anything that's street related. And that's not just what's in Chicago. When you see a when you see a person in Chicago, you got actors, you have people who are artists, like paint, because filmmakers are artists also. But you have people who do spoken word, you have store owners, everybody has a struggle. You can make a movie around that struggle. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to just be that. I was talking about Seinfeld earlier, and Seinfeld, even though he was the comedian, that was his job in the movie, in a TV show, but it was the life around him being that comedian. Mm-hmm. That's what people need to focus on. And
the stand-up was the worst part of the show. I ain't gonna lie to you.
Yeah, but so with me not using the N-word is strictly because I wanted people, when they see this movie, not to feel uncomfortable reciting the lyrics. I'm not lyrics, reciting the dialogue in the movie to their friends.
I love that. Because it's not, I mean, as Black filmmakers, that's something we have to be aware of. That our contemporaries don't feel like, you know, they're having to weigh those kind of concerns with building their projects. I know when writing, I wonder if, not, obviously it's not a hindrance to you. You've already, you know, I've gathered this is what I'm going to do in my head. I'm going to expand past that. But it is a certain hill I find interesting to talk to Black filmmakers about. I want to talk to Dee McGee. Any
transition? I mean, speaking of Tarantino,
but wait a minute, Sean, let me ask you a question. Sean, if you're telling your friends about this movie, do you feel comfortable telling them?
Oh,
about,
yeah. And without, like, without I can trying, write, I can write down my favorite quotes in my notes app and not have to be concerned for somebody seeing that over my shoulder.
Right.
Like, yeah, no, it makes total sense. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, so I could see a lot of, you know, like we mentioned Pulp Fiction when we were talking about music up top. Like there's obviously that like 90s independent spirit with the like Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez, like Guy just Ritchie. Shoot a fucking movie. I can see a lot of that influence here. I feel like, and we've been talking about, we had movies on movies in March. We were talking about Russ Meyer back mm-hmm. in February. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about John Waters has come up a bunch on the
Robert
podcast.
Robert Townsend, as a matter of fact. We talked about Hollywood Shuffle last month.
Yeah, we did talk about Hollywood Shuffle not that long ago. So where do you feel like Tubi specifically fits in? Like, especially with that spirit of like, if you don't like this, if you're talking shit, like go make a fucking movie, go make something better than this. Then like, where is, do you feel like there is more or less of that independent spirit available with these outlets like Tubi?
People are making whatever they want to make these days. They are not making movies. And when I say they're not making movies, I mean, not making movies. It's the quality, all of that. It's wild because when you think about probably 15, 20 years ago, the amount of movies that you see out now, you wouldn't have seen. Now you see everything. It's like the floodgates have opened. And when you see the movies that are posted online that are bad, you know, you think that they are getting credit for that, but they're not getting credit for it. So where does Tubi belong? I don't know. I don't have an answer to that question.
Yeah.
But hopefully, it belongs in the conversations y'all have in the future. Like, we saw Tubi the other day, and I hope it belongs in your conversation.
Hell yeah. I was going to say, bad movies paid my rent for a long time.
I got it. Mm-hmm. Tubi belongs in the conversation to other filmmakers as a blueprint of what not to do. That's where it belongs. Okay. It belongs in that conversation where you want to understand what not to do. Watch this movie and make sure that your continuity is on point.
But I mean, even more than that, I'd say just like getting it done. Like, I think that's the thing.
Yeah.
It's a blessing and a curse because it is, like you said, the onslaught of stuff that is put out there is like you can't even hope to keep up with it. And so then audience gets fractured and all that. But the ability to just put something out there and learn from it is also, I think, a valuable resource. So it's interesting.
Well, people want to be involved or see a good movie. Everybody wants to be involved and see a good movie. Nobody wants to see something that's trash at all.
Yeah.
You know, if you see something that's trash and, you know, it's whatever, it's like, you know, because like I said, the floodgates have opened. And then, matter of fact, Netflix, let's not even talk about Tubi. Let's talk about Netflix. How often have you been on Netflix and just watched previews for 3 or 4 hours and didn't watch anything and then just said, forget it, I'm turning this off. Mm. You get what I'm saying? So it's making a good movie is the thing that I think is the most prevalent now because even the studios, they're not making good movies anymore. They're making movies that go straight to streaming. And they say, figure that they can get their money from streaming platform, put their movie on for however long. And the streaming platform is saying, all right, well, so since Paramount made this movie, cool, it's on our platform and we're going to get people to watch it because Paramount made it. Instead of putting movies in the theaters where they should be, where we can have a community, laugh together, cry together, be afraid together, and have a feeling of belonging to something that somebody else, you know, is a part of that we don't even know each other, but we all feeling the same.
Yeah.
We having the same feeling, the same experience. So, you know, it's kind of
I want to jump off that Tarantino conversation real quick to ask you about the structure of your film. So you mentioned you're thinking about it a lot and then you vomit it out. So obviously you're thinking Pulp Fiction. Yeah, Pulp Fiction in the mind. We start structurally not only with the title, doing homage to Pulp Fiction, but I think we start immediately with the Royo with Cheese sort of rendition with two guys in the car having a conversation.
Yeah, that's the second scene. That was on purpose.
Yeah, I'm wondering.
The credit build up and the second scene, that's on purpose.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. I'm wondering what Tarantino's early work meant to you in terms of a filmmaker. Like, what was it about the opening of Tarantino's film that you felt structurally fit what we were trying to do here in Tubi movie? Or was it just for a laugh or a joke? Like,
no, I wanted that to feel familiar. But what's funny about you just asking me about Tarantino's film, when it was at the theaters, I didn't see it.
Interesting.
When it came back to the theater, I went and bought the DVD. Said, let me see what this is. I went and bought the DVD. I could have rented it, but I went and bought the DVD. I said, let me see what this is about. Put the DVD in. It was like, watch it to the credits. Call, what's that, 444 film to get the movie times, and went to the next showing at the theater to see the movie. Mm. Because I was at home getting that whole, what the? Oh, I was by myself, but I was feeling crazy because nobody was around me. And I'm getting goosebumps by telling you that because I was having this experience that I wanted to be a part of that experience. So then I went to the theater and I got that experience. Mm-hmm. But when you make a good movie and you throw it on a streaming platform, you know, nobody gets that experience. As a matter of fact, you probably saw this on one of the podcasts I was on where I said, now to fill that void, these social media platforms, they allow you to put a person down at the bottom of the screen going, ha, 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 to help you laugh or laugh with you while you're watching something.
Yeah.
Or laugh in the background.
The like green screen.
No. And I'm like, as soon as, if I'm watching something, it's either funny or it's not. I'm not, as soon as I hear that, no, I swipe out of it. I don't need you to tell me what's funny. I know what's funny from my experience of being around what's funny. Even if somebody fall down some stairs, depending on how they fell down the stairs, it's funny. But that whole experience of going to the theater and being around all those people, and we all feeling the same thing that we felt, people like, oh my God, the needle, all that, that was it for me. That was it for me. So
yeah,
I wanted people to have the same experience with Tubi, but apparently we're in cyber world. So people experienced it at the theater though. They did it 7 times at the theater. So it's screened at the theater 7 times, but on the phone now or on their computer or their television or iPad or what do you call that? Notepad, whatever it's called. That's how they experience it now.
So. I wouldn't sell it short, though. I had a good time with it. I ain't going to lie to you.
I appreciate it. But think about how much of a time you would have had.
An audience.
Yeah.
Oh, in the theatrical setting? For sure. Yeah. That's all, yeah.
Yeah. You would have slapping. Somebody would slap your knee. You would slap their knee. Right. High-fiving and shit, you know?
I want to jump into your role as a director. I think one of the lessons you learned early in your career was directing talent and not letting actors kind of go off on their own and kind of do things. So I wonder, I'm curious, not only, and I believe you learned that on your second feature, your second project, I shouldn't say feature. I'm very curious how your process has developed with working with actors from that second feature till now. Like, have you gotten more sophisticated? Maybe not the right word, but I like running rehearsals. I like doing actor exercises. I do line reads. I give direct, like, how has the process changed for you?
You see my head saying no to all of those.
No.
So let me tell you a reason. I don't do table reads, but I'm not against those. And I say you do one. And the reason why you do one table read is because you have everybody around, you give them notes on their scripts. And then, so they know what to do when they come to set, and then that's it. So as far as I go as a director, I have the final word on everything. If you have an idea, you can bring it to me and I'll do it only after we finish my shot list.
Yeah.
After we finish my shot list.
Get what
list,
you need.
Right. We're going to do all these money shots first. And then, all right, now I'll come back to you because I'm not going to listen to you. I say, wait a minute. Tell me after we finish the shot list. Mm-hmm. I'll say, hey, George, we finished the shot list? Yep. All right. So, Eric, what you got? And a lot of times I say, never mind. Because a lot of times people are trying to be a director and say, oh, I see he doing this, that, and the third. And then they come in and now we stay true to our shot list. And then once we finish with the shot list, we always have time because it's a 2-hour shoot. It's not no It's not no 12-hour. It's not a 12-hour day. We have enough time to, if anybody got a
God,
if they I have wish. If they have a you know, concern or they want to do something again, we have enough time because I got there an hour before. The crew got there an hour before that. I mean, hour after that. And then the talent show up, we shoot. Mm-hmm. There's no rehearsals. The blocking is already done because it's tape on the floor where you're supposed to stand with numbers on it. You start on this line, two is this line, three is this line, four is this line, and you keep it moving. So we have everybody moving where they're supposed to move without me having to tell people, all right,
yeah,
on this, you should go over here this time. All right, over here, you stand over here, and none of that. We have tape on the floor, so everything's marked. And this, I call it being efficient. And mm-hmm. also, I'm the captain of the ship. Mm-hmm. So you ask, yeah. how's it me being a director? I'm the captain of the ship. I take suggestions after we get that shot list done. As soon as that shot list is done, the suggestions, you can give me whatever suggestion you want. But a lot,
I like that.
Every time, nobody's giving me a suggestion after the shot list is done. They'll break in while we're doing the shot list and say, you know, I was thinking maybe we can hold that thought. Let's get the shot list out the way and I'll come back to you. And then they feel a little like I blew them off. And then we're done. All right. What was that thing you said you wanted to do? Never mind. Oh, you sure? Because we got enough time. Hey, y'all busy? And some people, oh, I expected to be here 10 hours. I didn't know we was finished. It's an hour and 30 minutes in. It's like,
yeah, right.
Hey, we still got time. You want to do it? Never mind. Because they want to go home too. So after the fact, they say, I got an idea. I said, give me a second. Come back to you. So you about to strike the set? Yeah. Unless you want to do your idea. Oh, never mind. Yeah, that's cool. We good. And that's it. I hope I answered your question.
That was excellent. Because I feel like efficiency seems like a motto and something I'm hearing recurring through interview.
I don't have to be the best director, but I got to be the most efficient.
Absolutely. I'm curious. So that efficiency running up against, you know, budgets and maybe actors of varying talents or whatever. Talk to me about maybe something that didn't go quite is planned. Like, what was your worst day on set and how you navigated that, how you overcame that? What was some of the challenges you faced on a Tubi movie in terms of the shooting, the actual production of it?
Damon showed up late. He showed up late as hell the first shoot. That's because he was doing promos for other stuff, but it wasn't nothing against him. And I understood, you know, because he had worked as a comedian. He got to do promos or whatever. And he said, I'll show up for the next day. And he showed up for the next day. I mean, he showed up the next day on time, but that was the only thing. But we was just sitting. It was like we hurried up to sit down and wait. And we just sat around for the whole day and waited. But that was it. I mean, but that was, I don't even think that was something I had to work through. We just had to wait.
Mm. Yeah.
And the thing is, since I wanted him as that character, it wasn't like I'm like, you know what? He's fired. No, I wanted him as that character. So I was understanding enough to be like, all right, well, I understand that, you know, what I have going on. I also understand you have stuff going on. So, you know, we met somewhere in the middle. And then, you know, he's been very instrumental in promoting the movie, too. You know, he's been one of the very few cast members that's been straight up promoting. And he went on Fox with me to talk to. He didn't have to go. He didn't have to do that. It could have just been me up there trying to make that lady laugh. He made the lady laugh with his ashy ankles. So, yeah, I appreciate him.
And speaking of him and like you're talking about the way that you like don't do a lot of rehearsals, don't do a lot of table reads. That's surprising to me, especially because he had such great chemistry with his co-star. And there's a lot of pairs in the movie, I feel like, have really good chemistry with each other. So is that something that you like particularly have an eye for when you're writing? Or is that something like, are you like picking actors that already have that pre-built chemistry? Kind of, I think, I can't remember what movie we talked about where that was something. Oh, that was
casting.
That was a thing that George Romero does in Dawn of the Dead. I'm remembering he does the newscasters arguing is like two guys that know each other. So they're just like have that chemistry of like two bickering dudes. But so is that something like how did you achieve that chemistry without doing a lot of table reads?
Those actors were just good.
Just hire the right people, like the old school mantra.
Yeah, pretty much. Because so if you're not good, I shot majority of the movie. I say 98% of the movie I shot. The only time I did not shoot is when you saw me in the movie.
Okay.
That's the only time you didn't see me shoot. But other than that, I was behind the camera. So what I've learned about myself in the past is if you're a bad actor, I can't shoot. I have to stand and babysit you. Mm. But if you're a good actor, I could just stay behind the camera and let you do your work because I'm not watching you. I'm watching the screen and making sure it looks good on screen, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because the actors are the driving engine. They're just basically doing their job. And
yeah,
I'm just doing my part of the job, making sure they look good on camera and making sure it look like it makes sense. Because in the trailer, when Adele pulls the poster, I mean, the doctor pulls the poster of the cracked skull. Mm. Now, we were getting ready to shoot. And I said, look, we can't shoot. And people are like, but you are always shooting everything else. You running straight through that. I said, we can't because Adele's not going to be ready. They said, man, she a comedian. She know. I said, she is not going to be ready. So when he pulled it and said, according to his x-ray, she laughed for 10 minutes. She laughed for 10 minutes, messed her makeup up. And I'm like, this is why I said she has to see this part because she wasn't ready. She wasn't ready for that. Because that took everybody out. Bit. That took everybody out when he, according to his x-ray, like, right. Is that somebody draw? Did somebody just draw a fucking skull with a crack through it?
I was already in love with the smoking jacket doctor lab coat in the first place. The skull just sends it.
Yeah. So I'm just working with people who are they're good. Those all the actors in the movie were actually good enough where I didn't have to babysit anybody, and they delivered.
As we're wrapping up here, I want to kind of dive into a few more influences. There's a post that somebody made on socials a few weeks ago I love, where it said, everyone's a cinephile until it comes to Black cinema. And part of my goal here on this podcast is to introduce our audience to Black cinema classics. Very curious with you, what maybe Black cinema classics can you share with our audience that maybe influenced Tubi movie, your filmography? I know you had a brief running with Townsend, and he had an inspired story there that I love. You had a questionable take with Friday a little earlier. We maybe not get into, but what is a classic Black cinema that has meant something to you over the course of your career?
Oh, I say Boys in the Hood, and the reason why Boys in the Hood, is because I feel like I want to make sure that we don't stay in that same rut of showing those types of movies because it's a whole movie about just all bad stuff, all types of bad stuff. And I want to make sure that, you know, we are out here as doctors, we are out here as lawyers, you know, and make the stories kind of that make people understand that we're not, we can be more than what we just see on TV because everybody's aspiring to be like these people that they see on television right now, which is rappers. And, you know, you see the little young Black dudes walk around with their heads covered all the way. I'm saying, summertime, bro. I got ops. I'm like, you got ops like that? Stay in the house. Stay in the house.
The shiesty on.
Yeah. So, you know, I think Boys in the Hood has influenced me to want to make movies that's not like it. Now, you want to talk about Friday. I understand. It's okay.
We can talk about all Friday. The more reason to love Friday.
So
I do what
recently. Okay. Recently, I heard that Ice Cube wore the same shorts and the t-shirt that he had on and as Doughboy and Boys in the Hood to show that it was a continuation of he didn't just die off. Life still went on and now he's part of something different. I understood that and I understand that. And me personally, it's like, okay, I get it. But with Friday, I watched it one time with the volume down. And when I watched it with the volume down, I can see, since I'm a writer, now I call myself a writer. I didn't know I was a writer, but I'm a writer. I can hear all the improv in the movie. And that bothered me because when you improv and you don't really know what you're doing, because comedians improv, I'm not going to say they don't know what they're doing, but they both competing not to be the butt of the joke. Somebody's fighting for the funny. And that's what I saw when I watched it. And I watched it, I was like, this movie isn't everything everybody else says.
You know, I've heard, what am I going to say here? I think that critique is interesting because I think for my money, Cube and Tucker play a very Abbott Costello straight man. I'm going to do the crazy thing very well for my, like, clearly Cube is the hair trigger reactionary type of character, where I think Tucker plays a very submissive kind of, but funny, you know, sidekick in a really interesting way. I think they handle duos in the very similar fashion that you handle it in Tubi movie, to where the give and take is a lot more clear and evident for me. And I like the back and forth, like, you know, Bernie Mac coming in and doing the Miss Parker, 2020 twin, like all of this, it for me as a cinephile, someone that enjoys filmmaking, gives that the other side of the coin that you were talking about with Boys of the Hood, to where everything is, you know, just dire and we're shooting guns. Like Cube, what I thought the genius, the brilliance of that movie, and we're going to get into tomorrow, is he captured life in media res the most honestly in these environments that I've seen, where, yes, there's a heightened exaggeration to it, but the sense that, you know, we have fun in the hood. We laugh. You know,
right.
it wasn't all bad, but that's
the thing I appreciated about Friday. But here's the difference between Friday and Tubi. The only part in Tubi that was improv was my daughter and I. Everything else was scripted.
I wanted to bring that. I'm so glad you mentioned it. Please talk to us about your daughter in the cars and everything, because that to me was a stroke of brilliance.
Because even though it's a Tubi movie, the follow scene when he was following the guy to his house, it was taking too long for me. And I could have let it play out that long and, you know, have people complain or whatever. But I felt like if I dropped something else in it, so I asked one of the actors, the guy that was in the car, I said, I was thinking about dropping this in. And he said, try it. So then I called my daughter and asked her, I said, would you do it? She was like, all right. And then no script. And we went out there and then she was just struggling with the cars and like, Dad, I'm called. I'm like, director.
That's so funny. I love that was like born out of a just like you feeling the edit drag a little bit. The edit is so sharp in this that that makes total sense. It's such a little breath of levity in the middle of it. It's just like sincerely adorable, where it almost kind of breaks the satire for a minute. It lets you like breathe from it, and then you get right back into the rest of the movie. It's perfectly placed.
And I cut the score, so you can just hear us out there in the street struggling with the cars.
Love it. One of the most beautiful scenes. I want to ask you one last question before we go out, because you had a sinner's take that I didn't. I was, being it close to From Dusk Till Dawn, I felt, and the reason why I want to pull your card here is because clearly this movie is heavily referential. And I think if we all have a shared love of Tarantino, who is the ultimate, I'm going to take some shit from another film, Lady Snowblood, City of Fire, like anything, and stick it in my movie, how we could have that taken sinners. I'm a little curious about. So I want to invite you to not only respond to that, but to say one nice thing about Ryan Coogler's Sinners. I'm very curious what your response to that would be.
You said one nice thing. Okay.
You couldn't have watched that scene of us dancing and not had a smile on your face.
I liked it, but I felt it was the same thing that I felt like when I see a sex scene in a movie, you're running the tape up. That's what I felt. I felt like, I mean, with that, since you pull that scene out and you specifically grab that scene, I feel like that scene is basically like watching a sex scene. It's running the tape out. It didn't need to be there because it doesn't do anything to move the story forward. It's just telling you background on how everything has evolved through music or whatever. But other than that, it does not move the needle forward. You come out of that and then here we are, boom. And I think I'm guilty of doing something similar to it, you know, but it was a sex scene. You know what I'm saying? So at the beginning of My Enemy's Son, it's a woman dancing sexual to start it off. That's running the tape out. So I believe that it's so many. You know, I like vampire movies, and I like Blade because Blade's, it was a different take on the vampire movies, which silver was their weakness. And, you know, silver is actually the weakness of, werewolves. But in Blade, silver's their weakness. Crosses don't do shit, you know, that's, that type of thing. So I felt like it should have been something new added to that particular genre. So with these vampires, you know, it's got having to be invited in. I can't think of it. His name was on the tip of my tongue, but it was, I think he was in the 60s or 70s. He had these vampire movies that they got whole things where he hitting stakes and the blood's just shooting all over his face or whatever.
Brian Stoker, Coppola's Dracula springs to mind. I'm not sure if that.
No,
are you talking about the parody one, the Leslie Nielsen?
No, like, this is way before that. Leslie Nielsen parodied that.
Okay.
I can't think of his name, but it shows a shot of him from lower coming up, and he has a stake in his hand, and he's hitting it with a hammer, and he's hitting it, and the blood just shoots all over him. I feel like that, you know, if you're going to do something that's supposed to be new, let's add something new to it. I mean, we can take some old stuff, but hey, the only way you can get in here is you're invited. What? Come on. But then when I was sitting in the theater and I was like 15 minutes in, I said, wait a minute. Two brothers stole money heading down south. Hold on. Dusto died? Shh. This is Dusto. Shh. I'm sitting up there like this Dusto will die.
Today's guest, Will Adams. His film, 2B Movie, is available on Plex and Mansa.
Plex, and, Mansa, and Folsom now.
You said Folsom?
Yep, Plex, Mansa, and Folsom.
And Folsom, we want you all to go check it out. Really funny satire on what's going on in today's landscape with 2B movies. Will, thank you so much for joining us. And I wanted to invite you back with, I believe, is it Fluke? Can you tell us a little bit about your upcoming project?
Fluke is a series that revolves around out-of-work actor who fails upward.
So, okay.
You know, and Fluke meaning bad, I mean, not bad luck, but dumb luck.
It's a fluke,
He gets things out of dumb luck. He gets laid out of dumb luck. He gets a job out of dumb luck, you know. So it's not a show about nothing, but it's a show about dumb luck.
We were just talking about Seinfeld, right. So I like it. It's like a little twist on the Seinfeld conceit. There we go. All right, so that was Will Adams. Please watch his film again, 2B Movie, available on Plex, Mansa, and Folsom. Will, thank you so much for joining us, and we do invite you back when Fluid is up and running. So
LOKEKEY.com, that's what you can find everything about me. LOKEKEY.com, that's my website.
Alright.
Hey, if you made it to the end of our show, you're the real MVP, and we want to thank you. If you want to reach out to us, email us at makemewatchpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on all your socials at makemewatchpodcast. Links are in the show notes. If you rate and review, shout out to you. Thanks. I'm going to tell you a little something. Sean doesn't want you to know there's exclusive content on our Patreon page where you can go to support the show, but you didn't hear that from me. Anyway, artwork by Supplybox, theme song by Soul Spy. Coming soon, folks.